Welcome to Biodiversity Speaks. I'm Dr. Helena Jolly, a scientist who studies human-nature relationships. Today we have a very interesting speaker. Her profile describes her as an applied conservation scientist, spatial and movement ecologist, large mammal biologist, an Appaloosa rider, skier, and mountain biker. She develops research and data science on biodiversity conservation and wildlife ecology. Angela is a World Wildlife Fund Fellow and has worked in various parts of the world studying ecology and management of large mammal species and their movements in landscapes. Please welcome Dr. Angela Brennan, Research Associate and Conservation Scientist at the University of British Columbia. Hello, Angela. Thank you for taking time to join.
Thanks so much, Helena, for inviting me to come here and talk about this stuff with you. I'm really excited to be here.
I have met you many times, but I haven't really had a chance to ask you this one question. Where did your journey as a conservation scientist start?
Wow, yeah, that's kind of a big question, I think. That like defines my whole life, literally my whole life, because it all started when I was a young girl, falling in love with horses and spending time every free day that I had riding that horse in the state parks around my hometown in Minnesota. And also about reading about horses, like their ancestors, their relationships to other equids. Yeah, I just kind of wanted to be outside enjoying nature with my horse. And at first, I wanted to be a veterinarian. But when I went to university, I started taking some field biology courses, mostly in aquatic science, which is kind of strange to me now. But those were such a cool experience that sort of like melded my interest previously with nature to thinking about nature through a scientific lens and, you know, seeing all the important intricacies and connections in nature. And then also to see the impacts that humans can have on that. So yeah, my interest in all of that and all of this kind of just grew more and more after that point, but started when I was very young.
I know that you love horses, and in your profile, there's a description of Appaloosa rider. So for our listeners who, like me, probably don't know what a Appaloosa is, it's an American horse breed best known for its colorful spotted coat pattern. Can you give us more details about what this particular breed of horse means to you? I know it's very close to you, and you just told us that, you know, love for your horses in some way influenced your interest in conservation biology.
Well, I love all horses, and really my love of horses was just like, you know, kind of that typical girl horse love that happens. For a lot of people, it fades. For me, it didn't. So I love all horses, not just Appaloosas, but my last horse was an Appaloosa. And I had to sell him a couple years ago to move to British Columbia. He was beautiful, fiery, black Appaloosa with white spots.
Oh, beautiful.
Just really, really cool. He was a character and taught me a lot. In particular, he's very nervous and skittish. You know, I had to learn how to teach him patience and calm. So that was a really fun experience. But, you know, like horses are just these majestic, large mammals. And though they aren't wild, they have all these behaviors and interactions with their environment that I think all sort of translate into the science that I do. Yeah, so the Appaloosa thing is, it was new for me. He was my first Appaloosa.
So do you get to go on horse rides here in Vancouver, or do you have any place?
No, so it's so funny that we're talking so much about horses, because my partner just last night was like, you haven't been talking about getting a horse lately. What's up with that? And where I spend a lot of time is in a place called Goldbridge, British Columbia. My partner has a place there. He has 10 acres of land, and there's some free range horses. So our neighbors just, they free range their horses. So those horses can eat grass anywhere. And often those horses come into our yard. Oh, and nice. So I actually spend time with horses pretty much every day now that I'm here. I don't get to ride them, but it's still pretty fun.
Congratulations on your very new research paper, Functional Connectivity of World's Protected Area, that was recently published in Science Journal. It's got really great review, and I've read the paper. It's a fantastic paper. And in the paper, you describe worldwide connectivity challenges of mammal population. I want to hear all about it. But before that, would you like to explain to our listeners, what are these connectivity challenges, or what is this connectivity and protected area? What's the link between that?
That's a great question. And thanks for saying all those nice things about the paper. That's nice to hear. So I want to back this up just a little bit to explain. We are facing a biodiversity crisis with more than a million species facing extinction. And we have this rapid environmental change that is accelerating the problem. So that's land and sea use change. And we often rely on protected areas like national parks and wilderness areas and provincial parks to aid in biodiversity conservation. So they're seeking to maintain ecosystem integrity, the natural qualities of the area. So, you know, protected areas, they are the cornerstone of biodiversity conservation, but they have shortfalls in their ability to protect many species. Many protected areas are just not large enough to encompass the space needs of many animals. And 90% of those protected areas are encompassed by humans and human land uses. And the evidence is mounting that many species avoid moving, or they just move less in human-dominated landscapes. So this is a big deal, because that means animals may not be able to access important resources. And essentially, these protected areas and the animal populations that they contain can become isolated, like islands in a sea of human land use. If that happens, gene flow and the flow of animals, the flow of individuals and nutrients, that could all grind to a halt. And that could drastically affect ecosystem health and species persistence. So this is where connectivity comes in. Mm-hmm. Connecting our protected areas can help ensure that the flow of those ecological and evolutionary processes can continue. And so technically, connectivity describes the degree to which the landscape is accommodating to animal movement. So if you can imagine like concrete landscape compared to landscape with parks and natural river corridors, mm-hmm. the concrete landscape is generally not accommodating to animal movement, whereas the other landscape is, or could be. It's more permeable. It's less risky to move. So those are like the key things to think about. But what's also key is that this year is especially important to start thinking about connectivity and its conservation, because the parties to the Convention on Biological Diversity are meeting in December in Montreal to discuss and agree upon the global biodiversity conservation agenda for the next decade. And connectivity is being recognized as important to these goals.
Oh, that's fantastic.
So, yeah. So basically, you know, massive conservation action is needed. And one of the key ways to make action happen is taking place in a few months. So that's the background of the research. And what we found is that we were able to develop a metric that reflects how connected protected areas are from the viewpoint of moving mammals. And that metric can then be used by nations to monitor their progress towards meeting those global conservation goals. So that was one thing. And then another thing we identified the world's most vital areas for connectivity. And that can then be incorporated into global conservation blueprints to capture this dimension of biodiversity that hasn't sufficiently been considered.
This is such a great study, Angela. The more I was reading about it, I clearly see that why it's so relevant. Also, while reading the paper, I noticed that in this particular paper, you were studying the movement of large mammals worldwide, and you quantified their connectedness to protected areas, mapped the world's critical areas for connectivity conservation. So tell us about, like, how did the study happen? Like, what were the discussions or the events that led to the inception of the study?
Yeah, it's one of these stories that I think is really interesting, because it's kind of like this, you know, alignment of interests. So before starting my position at UBC in 2019, I was working for the World Wildlife Fund on large mammal connectivity conservation in the world's largest transfrontier conservation area located in Southern Africa. That landscape is called CASA for short. It stands for the Kavango-Zambezi Transfrontier Conservation Area. So connectivity was a focus of my research, and my colleague, Dr. Robin Naidu, who's the lead scientist for World Wildlife Fund, and who I was working with wondered if we could scale up our work in CASA to study global connectivity. And then shortly, you know, after that, I started working at UBC with Dr. Claire Kremen. And literally, just as I started, she was organizing this workshop where Robin and I and other co-authors on the paper started discussing how we could look at global connectivity. So it was like these interests kind of aligned and the idea just gained traction. And then away we went. And 2.5 years later, the research was published.
Yeah, that's a really cool story of how such a global study came into being. Angela, as a person who works with these kind of large set of data at a very macro, you know, global level, I'm sure listeners would love to know, how intense was the study? And like, how did you conduct this global study? Did you have like multiple partner agencies across the world? And where did you get the data from, the processes behind that?
Yeah, I mean, this was a really intense study, but we were lucky to be able to rely on a previously published study in Science that looked at mammal movement and the effects of human pressures on the environment on mammal movement. So that study used upwards of 600 movement data from more than 600 individuals from 57 different species of mammals. And I think I have those numbers right, but they might be a little off. But it's a lot. It's a lot when you're thinking about, you know, accumulating movement data. And movement data means like these individual animals have GPS collars. So these collars are recording a location at a fixed time interval, and that time interval depends on particular question of interest, so it varies, but basically they're recording a location while that animal is moving. And so a lot of these studies are occurring across the globe. Many of these data aren't publicly available. And that research and Science that I mentioned, we were able to capitalize on movement data that was publicly available, but then they also collaborated with a lot of people and brought in new data. So they had a lot of data. So we wanted to build on that because they found such an interesting relationship between movement and human pressures on the environment. So we started there. We started with that research and the data from that. And then we had to employ this well-established methodology for modeling connectivity. It's also a little different from how you would typically think that ecologists would study animal behavior and animal movement and ecology. And what it is it's called circuit theory. Huh. So it's essentially relating the flow of animal movement across a heterogeneous landscape to the flow of electrical current across a circuit. Like I said, this is a well-established methodology, and it's now being used by hundreds of different researchers and conservationists to characterize landscape connectivity. It's really, an amazing tool that requires a lot of computational power. Mm-hmm. You know, typically you're applying this at kind of landscape scales or like regional scales, but we were the first to apply this to the global scale. And when you do that, you are really, really growing the size of the analysis. Like it requires a lot of computational power. That's memory and a lot of like traditional desktop computers don't carry the amount that we need to be able to do this. You know, so that's why, and one of the reasons why the research took so long, 2.5 years, because we had to figure out ways in which we could make this analysis feasible. Yeah, so it was intense for sure. And we learned a lot in the process, you know, what types of computers we can be using. And we had to go to the cloud. We had to use virtual computers so that we could have like 130 or 128 CPUs with 600 and some odd gigabytes of RAM.
That's intense.
Yeah. And then, you know, that's just for one piece of the analysis. So you have like many different computers of that size that are sort of helping you. And then, of course, you have to run these things many, many times in order to like identify errors and figure out how it's working and things like that. So it's never like you run it once and everything is good. So it was a ton of work.
Wow. I can totally imagine like this is really intense. And like it probably took you like 2 years you mentioned?
2.5 years. Two and a half years.
Wow.
Yeah.
But we have some great results out of that work. So I'm glad that happened. And one of the results that I was reading is that the study ranks Canada as the third in the world for animal movement between protected areas. Which are the other countries which were ranked 1 and 2? And what are the factors that determine this ranking?
So what this is measuring the isolation of protected areas, the average isolation of a protected area in the nation's protected area network. So on average, Canada's protected areas are well connected compared to other countries across the globe. That doesn't mean that all of Canada's protected areas are well connected. There are many protected areas in the southern part of the country that are not well connected. So that's important to note that this is an average metric. High values indicate a higher degree of isolation on average, and lower values indicate a higher degree of connectivity on average. And this metric, it highlights how the connectivity of protected area systems are affected by human pressures on the environment.
And these values are determined by a set of measurement factors or something?
These values are measured by how permeable the landscape is to moving mammals. And that is determined by the relationship between mammal movement and human pressures on the environment through the use of circuit theory.
This is really fascinating, Angela. One other particular point that came to my mind was like one of the greatest benefit this particular paper was discussing is that the benefit that protection of wildlife happens when we create more protected areas, which is in combination with reduction of human footprint. So basically the paper is suggesting that for protection of wildlife, we need to have both these things, right? Creation of protected areas, also like reduction of human footprint. This sounds a very attractive proposition for conservation perspective, but as you have highlighted in the particular paper, the cost and ease of implementation of these strategies is expected to vary substantially among different land use and socio-political contexts. So according to you, which are the areas of the world do you think adapting this combination of, you know, reduction in footprint and creation of protected areas, it's going to be more challenging and why?
I think this makes sense, right? That to make landscapes accommodating for animal movement, we need to mitigate human pressures on the environment. That kind of makes sense. This doesn't at all mean kicking people out and will absolutely be a challenge in many parts of the world. And if connectivity conservation is a goal, it will require huge investment in local support and governance. But we have a lot of options and opportunities to make sure that landscapes are managed to become more permeable to moving mammals, such like, you know, retaining natural habitats within agricultural lands, removing fences where we can, building highway overpasses or underpasses, and restoring greenways and other stepping stones between our parks. So yeah, there's a lot of options and opportunity, I think, but there's also many, many challenges across many places.
This is really good to know because as someone who grew up in India, I found this piece on like reducing the human footprint a very interesting one. Because in many parts of the world, reduction of human footprint is not a very easy task, right? And a lot of people are dependent on these natural resources and forest landscapes. So you did suggest few of the ways in which these heavily populated places can reduce the footprint and aid in wildlife conservation. From your own personal experience, Angela, like you've worked in different parts of the world, which particular practice do you think is the most effective, like in these heavily human populated areas to reduce the footprint?
I mean, it's just going to vary. It's going to be so context dependent. It's a difficult and sensitive topic for so many reasons. I mean, but if we want to conserve connectivity and benefit from that, landscapes do need to be permeable for animal movement. Doing that from the ground up with local leadership is key to making it feasible and to make it work in the long term.
So which country do you think is doing well with, you know, with regard to these particular measures and things?
Well, you know, based on our research, we found that Canada does have many protected areas, particularly in the northern part of the country that are well connected. And, you know, there are many countries in Europe too that while they have many protected areas that are isolated, they are working to make connectivity conservation a priority. So I think I think there's a lot of opportunity for other countries to work on some of these measures, but it's going to just vary from region to region and country to country. It all depends on the resources and the local needs of people. If people need agricultural lands and they need to eat, they need to eat.
Yeah, because we also know that most of the conservation discussions often revolve around creation of more national parks and protected areas. But your study did also highlight that, you know, 66% of, you know, this conservation measures and conservation or connectivity conservation goals lie in these unprotected landscapes. So what does this unprotected landscape mean? And what is their significance for like global conservation?
Well, from our analysis, we found that these areas were globally the most critical for connectivity between protected areas. The fact that they're unprotected doesn't mean we need to immediately try to protect those areas. There's, like I said, there's a lot of opportunity and options for conserving connectivity. And our research found that mitigating the human footprint or human pressures on the environment is a really important way for making landscapes more permeable to mammal movement. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are other strategies, area-based strategies other than formal protected areas, like the CBD, the Convention on Biological Diversity, has a classification called other effective area-based conservation measures. And so those landscapes can be not formally protected, but they are contributing to biodiversity conservation in other ways.
And I also understand that in this paper, you discussed about connectivity of mammals. Now, my question is, if you think of any other animal group, do you think the model or the results would resonate with any other animal group other than mammals?
Yeah, so we studied connectivity for mammals. So what that is that's how our protected areas functionally connected for mammals. And we did that because we relied on that previous research that I mentioned before, published in Science, to do that, which relied on a lot of movement data collected from the 57 species of mammals and more than 600 individuals. And they showed this massive decline in mammal movement with increasing human pressures on the environment. So we saw that as an opportunity to build on that work and develop it around mammals. In our study, we showed that the world's most critical areas for connectivity for mammals overlapped with many areas of high biodiversity value, indicating the importance of these areas for other taxa. And basically, this model, I believe, will resonate for taxa that prefer to move in areas with less human influence. I think this map will correlate highly with that.
Maybe that will be your next study, I believe. So this study has been received, very well received and got like wonderful feedback. And most researchers who work in this particular field have appreciated it so much. Now, what happens now? Like, what do you plan next with these learnings and with this study?
Yeah, well, thanks again for saying all that. I really hope it's true. But, you know, like, I'm also hoping that it just generates a lot of discussion and a lot of research into connectivity and connectivity at this scale, so at the global scale. And I see a future with more data and computational power to increase the resolution and understanding of connectivity needs for many more species and to incorporate other global environmental layers as well. So we relied on the 2009 Global Human Footprint Map, but there's work on updating that and then creating annual updates on that, which is awesome. But all global layers have their faults. So I see people in the future examining those, working towards better and better descriptions of connectivity and just of our land use and the environment at a global scale. There's so much work to do with what we've done too, is looking at how protected area connectivity interacts with climate change and protected area resilience and population success and vulnerability. So yeah, it's kind of an exciting time now to explore some of those ideas.
Thank you, Angela, for this wonderful discussion. And you shared such beautiful insights on protected area connectivity and ways of maximizing our conservation effort. Good luck with your future research and work.
Thanks so much, Helena. Thanks for inviting me and having so much enthusiasm and positivity towards the research. I really appreciate that.
So thank you, everyone, for tuning in. If you want to hear more about Biodiversity Speaks, you can follow us on our socials at iBios Program on Twitter and Instagram handles. This episode is hosted by me, Helena Jolly, edited by Liam Reed, and assisted by Emma Jarek-Simard. We'll be back in a couple of weeks, but until we meet again, think of ways to reduce human footprint and how as an individual you can contribute to the global biodiversity conservation and connectivity work and studies. Thank you.